This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, it's the 57th anniversary of the West Papua independence movement, but with a recent clampdown over demonstrations in Indonesia, how will West Papuans mark the day? We'll speak to activist Benny Wenda about what he's doing, and archaeologists in Vanuatu have discovered an ancient site of Lapita pottery and bone fragments that could provide clues to the Pacific's ancient past.
The Lapita is quite significant to the Pacific history because it connects the Pacific Islands.
And we head to Uruguay, where countries are debating the creation of a plastics treaty. So, is it a talk fest, or will we see real action when it comes to plastic pollution? We'll hear from a Pacific negotiator to find out all that and more today on the show. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. So glad to have your company. First, though, to Fiji, where TikTok is fast becoming the battleground for the nation's upcoming election. So much so that in a bid to win over young voters, former coup leaders, military men, and longtime politicians are showcasing their dance and acting skills on the social media site. Some have even hired TikTok influencers to do so. And as Jordan Fennell reports, with the election just 2 weeks away, the heat is on to get the social media strategy just right.
Someone asked me the other day, do you ever lift, bro?
Sitiveni Rumbuka, Fiji's 74-year-old original coup leader, talks to the camera while wiping sweat off his face after finishing a workout.
And I said, yes, I used to, but now I'm more interested in lifting the standard of this country.
Since he joined TikTok a week ago, his videos have been watched more than 500,000 times. His most popular video is a skit of him shopping for fabric in a store, where an Indo-Fijian shop assistant approaches him with a question.
If me and people like me vote for you now, will we be okay?
I give you my word. I will look after Indo-Fijians of Fiji.
In 1987, Mr. Rumbuka led an ethno-nationalistic coup and overthrew the then Indo-Fijian-dominated government. That led to an exodus of non-Indigenous Fijians fleeing the country. He was later democratically elected as Prime Minister. Pacific Digital researcher Jope Tarai says this new TikTok skit is an attempt to speak to young Indo-Fijians in the country.
It's easy to weaponize that history against him. And so he's responding to that by seeking to assure those that were born within the millennium that we're in now that they are safe and that they are secure.
Alsheikh Ashad Ali is a 19-year-old Indo-Fijian university student. He's also a first-time voter. And he says he's seen that skit shared all over social media.
It's actually creative. You can see videos at the comfort of your house and then you can decide who is the best alternative for you to vote for.
The youth vote is a key target for Fijian politicians, with people under the age of 35 making up more than 60% of the population. It's known as the youth bulge, and Jope Tarai says one of the hurdles politicians face is making them care enough to get out and vote.
So you not only have to be able to engage with them, you have to speak their language.
And on TikTok, that language is dance. Another video shows Fiji's Labour Party leader Mahendra Chaudhry in an office surrounded by a group of dancers. Popular TikTok star Avishkar Kumar says he was hired to teach the 80-year-old the best moves.
When we entered inside the office, he was like, oh, I don't know how these things work. You need to teach me. I said, okay, sir, just feel comfortable and then we will do whatever we have to do. It was quite difficult for him, but he was really coping up with my team.
Mr. Chaudhry says the Labour Party really needs the youth vote to be successful at the election.
I'd like to take my message to the youth. They have a lot of problems here which need to be attended to, essentially jobs, employment. So we need to reach out to them, connect with them, be relevant.
Now, a week after Mr. Rumbuka and Mr. Chaudhry joined the platform, the current caretaker Prime Minister, Frank Bainimarama, has entered the fray, but with a slightly different approach.
I'm not here to dance. Leadership is serious business. It matters to young people who want better jobs in high-tech industries.
Jopet Rai says for a political message to be successful on TikTok, it has to be tailored to the site.
The platform is about entertainment. So it's not necessarily a Twitter-like platform where there's a lot of serious policy, political ideology discussions.
He says in Fijian politics, polarizing views are a big challenge, and that TikTok as an entertainment space provides a unique opportunity for candidates to neutralize that feeling and connect with voters.
You create an avenue of engagement that isn't conceited, but creates some conciliation in, if you don't agree with me, at least you can give me the space to listen to me for a few seconds. If you're not going to vote for me, at least you can sort of enjoy this moment with me.
With just 2 weeks left until people head to the polls, our Sheikh Ashad Ali says Fiji's youth will be waiting to see which TikTok videos pop up next.
It is good that people are getting informed and well aware of who are the choices that they can choose from.
That was first-time voter Sheikh Ashad Ali, ending that report from Jordan Fennell with production help from Marion Farr. And Pacific Beat has reached out to Mr. Rambuka and Mr. Bainimarama for comment, but has not received a response.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Hope you're having a lovely Thursday morning. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. It was 57 years ago today that the West Papua movement was born. For the past five decades, activists have been fighting for separation from Indonesia and for independence. It's a struggle playing out not only in West Papua, but on the global stage as well. Joining me now from London is Benny Wender, leader of the United Liberation Movement for West Papua. Mr. Wender, welcome to Pacific Beat and good morning to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Though I guess it's a bit later in the day for you there, Mr. Wender. But let's actually go to West Papua. It's illegal to fly the Morning Star flag there, which has become a symbol for West Papuan independence. Do you believe that this will stop it going up, being raised today in West Papua?
Yes, this flag is, 1961 raised in West Papua, called Morning Star flag. This is, 1st of December is West Papua nation was born, and that nation was born stolen by the Indonesia. So I think today is very special day for us and across the world, and our solidarity around the world will raise the Morning Star flag. In our people in back home, across West Papua, will raise the prayer meeting, some of them prayer meeting, but across the Pacific, and in the other part of the world, here in London and in Oxford, we'll raise Morning Star flag in Oxford Town Hall, and also in Netherlands, Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu, and I think across the New Zealand, Australia, and US. That's first time US will be raised our solidarity. So it's significant, increase the support and solidarity.
Is it risky to raise the Morning Star flag in West Papua in Indonesia?
Absolutely. They're risky because today also we commemorate, Philip Karma was ended up in 15 years and he served 11 years. And one of the friends called Hilapok, died last year. Seven West Papuan were arrested, just raised the Morning Star flag and they put in prison. So he was died, and we part of the remembering all those died. So the Hilapok, he was in the prisons and he died in prison because of the Indonesia not treated well. So if you raise the Morning Star flag in West Papua, ended up in 15 or 20 years. I was arrested in 2002 and put me in prison. They charged me 25 years. I'm the luckiest person, but all my friends are not.
Yes, because you now live in exile there in England. We're talking to you now because, of what happened 57 years ago today on December 1st. Can you tell us why that date is significant? What happened 57 years ago?
This is because this day where first time our flag and our country recognized witnessed by Australia and British and France. And at the time, Dutch raised the Morning Star flag first time in West Papua soil, and that's the recognitions, and that's how West Papua nation was born on this day. You know, they call West Papua that flag. So until today, this is the our nation, our national day for all West Papua, where they in exile or in the bush or in refugee camp or in everywhere. So I think this day, every year we commemorate. Also today we will commemorate our, you know, reinstate our nationhood was stolen. We announced our, you know, provincial government of United Liberation Movement that reclaim and reinstate our country.
And now, Mr. Winter, is it becoming more difficult to lead this movement for independence in West Papua? I mean, you just mentioned that, you know, the movement has lost some senior leaders just this year, including, as you mentioned, Philip Kama, who turned up dead on a beach, and there are calls for investigations to proceed into his death. How do you feel about the recent activities there in West Papua? Do you think after 57 years there's been progress on this question of independence?
Yes, we've seen the last 20 years make a lot of progress, and all those leaders also, you know, have been killed or been poisoned, and, you know, some of them aren't told story, and including Philip Kama, that is obvious cases, and this has been going on last 20, 50 years. So in terms of our struggle and our progress, we're making a lot of progress in our struggle, because, for example, now we, United Liberation Movement Provincial Government, you know, lobbies in the regions and in entire world as well, but also in the region. We are now member or observer in Melanesia Sphere Group, and in fact that 2019 Pacific leader, you know, adopt the resolutions and call UN High Commissioner visit to West Papua, but until today Indonesia not allow. And we can see the not only that, but also internationally, ACPF, Africa, Caribbean, Pacific, also call UN High Commissioner visit. And that you can see the progress we make in internationally. And the issue not become a domestic issue anymore. This has become international issue. So that we confidence. And today also we want to announce the institutional government and structure, including executive, legislative, judicative, and several regional executives. This is direct rejection of Indonesia's illegal occupations and division of provinces. So I'm calling, you know, upon my people to reclaim their freedom was stolen by, you know, from us. So that is why it's important today.
Yeah, just to clarify there, Mr. Wenda, so today have there been those regional leaders put in place? Is that what you're saying? To mark this 57-year anniversary, there's been some new changes made?
Yes. You know, this today we also, as I mentioned, we announced, you know, our institutional government structure, including our executive, judicative, legislative, and put in place and to reclaim our country stolen from us. So that is why this is important to commemorate also, you know, some of the leaders who were lost the fight for our struggle.
Yes, yes. A new executive group there for the United Liberation Movement for West Papua. And if you are just tuning in to Pacific Beat, we're speaking to the leader of that movement, Benny Wenda, from West Papua, though now you're, of course, in London, Mr. Wenda. Now, considering that new executive branch, and I guess trying to again call for independence for West Papua, you mentioned there that there has been also calls for the United Nations Human Rights Commission to visit West Papua, and those calls are growing. But that hasn't happened yet. Many put it to Indonesia, as you said, blocking that visit. Do you think it'll ever happen?
We believe that this is outstanding in call. So we believe that it will happen because why Indonesia not allow? And that is something happening. So I think that in the international community now cautious what really happening, what really going on in West Papua. Indonesia claimed a democratic country, then why is the UN not allow? And also eight country, UN Human Rights Periodic Review, there is eight countries are called, including United States and Australia, New Zealand, and the other country, including Netherlands, are speaking out about, full investigation. Marshall Island, Vanuatu, consistent to call UN High Commissioner visit West Papua and because of the Pacific leader. So Indonesia cannot ignore. Indonesia is a member of the United Nations. It should be respected. And this is almost 84 countries are calling UN High Commissioner visit. And that's why we believe that it's even Indonesia reluctant, but we pushing to UN High Commissioner visit must happen because thousands of the West Papuan are displaced. We know that world up attention, crisis in Ukraine. We are sympathy with them, but also West Papua suffering, 60 years suffering, and, there is no solidarity, attention. So hopefully, this is a turning point, and we believe it will happen.
Now, Mr. Wender, we're speaking to you on this 57th anniversary of the West Papuan movement. What is it like for you? Because you're in exile in London now. You can't go back to spend this day with your families and friends in West Papua. How does it feel to you for you to be away from your homeland during this important time?
It's very difficult at human level, but because my people are still cry for justice and freedom, I can't sleep. Even I'm here, I'm always 24 hours with my people connected because modern technology help to engage with my people in back home. And I want to see my people, want to free and then I will rest. Because while my people are suffering, while my people are, continue to suffer, I'm fight until justice will be prevailed. And I want to see my people enjoy their freedoms, just like other people and other brothers and sisters across the Pacific, across the Melanesia. I want to see one day have enjoy their freedom and reunite with the family and in the Pacific family.
Thank you, Mr. Wender, for your time this morning on Pacific Beat.
Thank you.
That was Benny Wender, the leader of the United Liberation Movement for West Papua. He was speaking to us from London to commemorate the 57-year anniversary of the West Papua Independence Movement. It's time, as always, to find out what's making news around the region. And to do that, I'm joined by Carl Evans. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning, Priyanka.
Have you been, were you up watching the game, the Socceroos game last night?
Oh, I don't quite love soccer so much to get up at 3 a.m. in the morning. But I did see the scenes. Yeah, absolutely incredible. And what a win as well to beat Denmark.
Was quite surprising. We're here in Melbourne and there have been scenes across the city of people coming together at 3 a.m. Here in Australia to watch that game and celebrate, really, particularly in Melbourne, which is a massive, I guess, soccer is a big deal here. So, and I'm sure across the Pacific, there are some soccer fans. Socceroos fans, I should say. I saw some flags being flown, including, apparently, did you know this MP, new MP Julia King is also barracking for the Australians in this World Cup, so...
I didn't actually know that, but speaking of flags, no kidding, I actually was still seeing Samoa flags in Melbourne, particularly down Chapel Street, which is the main street in Melbourne, on the weekend, believe it or not, two weeks after the game.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice to see. With such an epic game, I'm not surprised. But now let's head to Vanuatu because it is demanding clarity. Well, this is over how governments will protect future generations from climate change. I imagine this is all to do with that big ICJ advisory opinion bid. So what's the latest here?
Yeah, so Vanuatu, along with 17 other countries, so they've drafted a resolution to the International Court of Justice to get clarification over what responsibilities governments around the world will have to protect future generations from climate change. So this is a bit of a milestone for Vanuatu, who's been leading the charge on this front for a number of years now. And earlier this year, as we know, they lobbied to have governments essentially who don't take action on climate change to make that a criminal offence. So this resolution is basically on is basically to ensure that's on track, and it will also ask the court to define what those legal consequences will be if governments fail to act. And so this all comes ahead of the United Nations General Assembly set to vote on that resolution early next year.
Yes, we've been eagerly awaiting this, I guess, this draft resolution to be presented to the UN. It was supposed to happen in November during the General Assembly in New York, but it got pushed back and until now, I guess, and now we might see a vote next year. I understand that this International Court of Justice advisory opinion isn't legally binding, but there has been like this big movement really to get the courts to look at this issue of climate change, isn't it?
Yeah, it gained a lot of momentum at the COP27 climate summit in Egypt last month. I believe more than 80 developed nations actually are supporting the effort. So it's gained a lot of momentum.
Yes, and we'll see if that vote does get through. And this whole movement for the International Court of Justice to weigh in on climate change came as a result of students, law students in Vanuatu from the University of the South Pacific, taking this issue on board. So it's just amazing to see how far it's gotten, you know, first convincing the Vanuatu government, then them convincing other governments, and now to see it at the UN is pretty impressive.
Confidence of youth.
Yes, indeed. And now let's head to Papua New Guinea. They've handed down their biggest budget ever. So what is it all about?
Yeah, so PNG's Treasury Minister, Ian Ling Stuckley, he announced a $24 billion Kina budget yesterday. And the theme is mainly centered around support for households and lifting families sort of out of that cost of living crisis, which we're seeing worldwide at the moment. So it's basically, you know, it also includes significant tax hikes for banks too. So headlining the budget is a number of cost of living initiatives, the main one being plan to raise the minimum wage threshold by 50%. There's also going to be a 45% tax increase that's going to be imposed on the banking sector, which is going to net the government about a US $100 million in 2023.
Wow. Yes, lots of initiatives there announced by that Treasury Minister, Ling Stuckey. We saw quite a violent election recently in Papua New Guinea, where there are talks about reforming the Electoral Commission and indeed the police force to perhaps address some of that?
Interestingly, no. I couldn't find any reports that listed that. And there was a number of comments in the lead up to this budget that a lot of people wanted to see a reform in those areas because of just, you know, essentially how violent that election was. There was nothing in terms of the initial comments that I could find regarding it. It seemed very much economy-based, plans to lift their exports and investment into their main industries, such as your coffee, your fisheries, and you know, things like agriculture and stuff like that. And that included progressing a number of their large projects, one of which was listed was that Wafi-Golpu gold mine project, which has obviously been quite controversial. So, yeah.
Indeed. We've spoken here on Pacific Beat to the international activists and also the local activists who are against that gold mine project. Yes, very interesting stuff there. And we'll, I guess, see how all these promises pan out in the future. Now let's head to Samoa, some more money matters, because money appears this time to be standing in the way of bringing the Toa Samoa's World Cup heroes back home. What's been going on?
Yeah, it's a bit of an interesting one. So there's obviously been that ongoing campaign to bring them all back to Samoa for a hero's welcome on home soil and do a bit of a tour of the nation.
Ever since they beat England, I think there's been calls for them to suddenly get to make their way back. Yeah,
absolutely. But the president of Rugby League Samoa says a decision still hasn't been made on that front, which is quite surprising in a lot of ways. He says it all depends on financing and they still actually have to sit down with the government to discuss it. And this obviously comes after all the players expressed a real desire to do that. So, it doesn't seem that complicated, but it appears to be so. So it's a bit of a weird one.
I don't understand. I mean, what is the money that goes into it? I guess the flights, is that it?
Yeah, I mean, look, sport is a business. It can be easy to forget that sometimes. So I'm not sure if there's going to be a monetary incentive for the players to make that trip. But I guess you'd think for most of them, the money wouldn't really be a factor, would it?
Yeah, exactly. Because I can just imagine the crowds and the joy playing for such an iconic team at this time.
A lot of them obviously have NRL commitments as well. But, preseason training might be around the corner. There might be an issue on that front. But, yeah, look, hopefully it can get done.
Yes, hopefully it can. We saw the scenes here in Sydney. So, when Toa Samoa arrived at the airport there. So I can imagine even bigger celebrations in Samoa. If that ever happened. Thank you, Kyle, for those stories.
Thank you, Priyanka.
That was Kyle Evans bringing us the latest from around the Pacific. But don't go anywhere, because coming up here on Pacific Beat, we'll be heading to Uruguay, where diplomats from around the world are working out a new global plastics treaty. What is it? Well, we'll find out what leaders, particularly from the Pacific, are calling for. And we'll be speaking to Samoa's representative there in Uruguay. And after this short break, we'll be speaking to an archaeologist in Vanuatu about the discovery of an ancient Lapita site dating back thousands of years.
Love sport? Tune in to Can You Be More Pacific with Sarah Nangama and Dean Halatau.
The Australian government have announced that they will be supporting rugby union in Tonga, Samoa, Solomon Islands and Fiji. Think about Fiji, they've absolutely dominated on the world stage. So I'm like, do you guys really need the money?
Maybe they need to do some exchange with Fijian coaches.
Now that's a thought.
Over here,
I love that.
Can You Be More Pacific? Thursday night, 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Thank you for joining us this Thursday morning here on Pacific Beat. Hope you're having a lovely morning. For the first time in Vanuatu, Indigenous archaeologists have discovered an ancient Lapita site with shards of clay and animal bones that could date back thousands of years. The Lapita were an ancient Pacific people believed to be the common ancestor of the current Polynesians, Micronesians, and Melanesians. Archaeologist Edson Willey is working with the discovering team. Mackenzie Smith spoke to him and began by asking how the site was discovered.
We were looking at finding out about early settlements around the party, and we came up with this idea that most of the times the archaeology excavation and research were led by foreign researchers. The project was aimed at upgrading research tactics, research skills for local archaeologists. Yeah, we've been working with foreign archaeologists, and this one we discussed and we decided that this was going to be one of the first locally led archaeological excavation.
And did you have any idea of what might be there and what you might find?
We've had few discoveries where similar sites, similar location, geographical landscapes and all this. And this seemed, one of the team members actually scouted using Google Earth. And then the idea was to go around the places where we marked on Google Earth to look at the sites, potential sites. And this site was one of these sites that was marked out.
So the team found bones and shards of clay. Can you tell me a bit more about what they uncovered?
Yeah, there were pottery shards, bones, and it was located on what we call mounds. The villagers thought that it was just natural mounds, but the team saw that it was man-made mounds. And the site was also, we could suggest that it was big because there was not only one, but there was probably four or five mounds around the area.
And what's the significance of this find?
The discovery of the shards, the pottery, Lapita pottery shards themselves, serves as the earliest initial settlers, which is linked to the story that the ones they found on Teuma and other sites on the Vanuatu and the Pacific.
Can you tell me a bit more about who the Lapita are and what their significance is to the Pacific?
The Lapita is quite significant to the Pacific history because it connects the Pacific Islands, especially Vanuatu going east. the science of the earliest human science evidence is the Lapita. The initial settlers of the islands around the Pacific is Lapita. We haven't found anything that dates pre-Lapita.
And what are the plans from here? Are there more sites you'd like to see looked at?
Yes, there's other sites that are still in the initial discussion stage. We haven't decided on which sites to go to, but with this discovery, we'll focus on this one first. And plans are already eventuating where we're planning on going next year to carry out more research. The French embassy who funded the first trip going down to the Lapita discovery already indicates that they are willing to fund next year's research again.
That was Vanuatu archaeologist Edson Willie speaking there to reporter Mackenzie Smith. You're listening to Pacific Beat here on your Thursday morning. Hope you're having a lovely morning. My name is Priyanka Srinivasan. Roughly one rubbish truck of plastic waste is dumped into the sea every minute. But talks are now underway to try and scale back this pollution. For the first time, 180 countries are meeting to create a global plastics treaty that could see limits and caps set on these plastic products. Joining us now on the line from those talks in Uruguay is chair of the Pacific Small Islands Developing States, Fatumanavu Pao Lutero. He's also ambassador to the United Nations. Good morning to you, Ambassador Pao Lutero.
Morning, Priyanka. How are you?
I am very well and keen to find out what's happening there in Uruguay. I know you're representing the Pacific and small island developing states. What do you want to see come out of this meeting?
Well, you know, this what we will call a crisis in plastic is important not only to the Pacific small island developing states, but I think to the global community as a whole. And therefore, I think what we want out of this is a legally binding agreement that is applicable to all. It is also an instrument that should be fit for purpose. And that purpose is primarily to prevent, reduce and eliminate plastic pollution, and in particular also including microplastic in the marine environment. I think this is a transboundary issue, and therefore the engagement of the global community is extremely important. In framing this instrument, this legally binding instrument, I think our focus should be on key principles that will help us in putting together the content of the instrument or the agreement or treaty or whatever that might be. I think the important point is the legally binding nature of this agreement.
Sorry, Ambassador, I wanted to ask you about that legally binding agreement. What might that look like in particular? Ideally, obviously it's still being negotiated, but what do you see as the best case for to have this legally binding agreement?
Well, you know, it's a fairly complicated sort of negotiation process because you need to look at how we're going to structure the agreement as a whole. And this is where issues, for example, we deal with what we want to get out of this agreement, which will be the objective and the goal. I think we also need to look at issues of obligations, global obligation that binds all the member states who will be part of this treaty. I think we also need to look at what we will call means of implementation. How do we implement this treaty? And what are the financial means that will be available to country, and in particular, small island development states? I think one of the key issues here also is what we will call the final provisions. And this sets out, for example, the issue of entry into force of the instrument when it has been ratified. And this is where it becomes critical as to whether the treaty will enter into force when all member states have ratified, or a percentage, a proportion of the member states. And this is still something that we need to agree on.
Mm.
If it's all member states, as you would appreciate, it's going to take a long time because, you know, 193 countries in the UN is a lot of countries, and ratification process do take time within the national jurisdiction.
Yes, yes. As we've been seeing with climate change talks, getting 193 absolutely. Countries to agree is very difficult. I mean, what in specifically would you like to see when we talk about legally binding mechanisms? Is the objective to ban completely plastic waste?
Well, I think eventually what we also got to be careful about is that we do not sort of eliminate and ban all plastic without consideration of the alternative. What other products are they going to be put in place to replace those? And this is where I think in our Pacific Island context, you know, the use of local products, for example, is something that, you know, we need to look at very seriously. Part of this process, and it's something that we are also including from the Pacific side, is the issue of education. I think it's extremely important that, you know, the local community are brought up to date with the progress that are being made and how they can contribute, because it's a global crisis, and I think everyone has a role to play. And this is why also the multi-stakeholders forum and consultation that have been taking place INC meeting and yesterday as well is very important in bringing up other ideas in terms of how we can address the problem.
And Ambassador, I mean, you have called it a crisis, a global crisis, but specifically looking at the Pacific, why is it at this crisis point, the amount of plastic pollution, particularly in the oceans?
Well, primarily, if you look at the statistics, you know, we contribute as little as 1.3% of global plastic pollution. However, I think studies have clearly demonstrated that we are grossly and disproportionately affected by its impact. It's primarily very similar if you look at climate change. For us, we don't contribute much to the emission, but yet we are the most affected by the impact of climate change. So we're calling it a crisis because if we don't deal with this issue, it's going to affect our health. It's going to affect the environment, because if you look at the latest studies on microplastic and its impact on marine life, including fish, you know, crabs, whatever, you know, that is something that is of particular worry to all of us.
What impact is that? What impact is the plastics having on the environment and the people?
Well, you know, because the studies have now confirmed that plastic have gone into the fish. So when you eat fish, there is plastic in fish now. And the studies have also shown that by 2050, there will be more plastic in the ocean, if we don't do anything about it, than fish. So that's going to impact on health of our population.
Yes.
And I think that it's important that we do something about it. I think it also impacts on other area of our life in terms of the environment. I think we all know this. So I think that from the Pacific, we're very keen on moving forward with this. We're just starting the negotiation. Today was the first day. The first 2 days was about was a national statement, but now we're into the specific of what we need to put into the instrument, the legally binding instrument. It's going to take, at least another 3, 4, 5 meeting before hopefully we are in a position to report, because we're looking at the end of 2024. For the final report to be submitted to the General Assembly.
That so is a long
it's
way.
It's not much time.
Yes, yes. Well, not much time, but it sounds the negotiations have only just started, so there is a couple of years to go. How are those? I know it's still early, but how do you see those negotiations going? Are you seeing any challenges to your hopes to getting a legally a binding instrument when it comes to plastic pollution?
Well, we're optimistic, but I think, from our own experience, there will be some pushback from some countries in terms of how they see this problem being addressed. But we are confident that we are well prepared in terms of our arguments that we can put forward. And I think, again, we are saying that this is not a Pacific problem, although we are most impacted by it, it's a global problem. And that's why issues of a global obligations for all countries. And then we come down to the national level where we look at our own nationally determined commitment. So when you look across to the climate change negotiations, it's a very similar sort of approach in that manner. We have the ambition. We've got to make sure that we are ambitious in setting targets that will guide the work. I think we have to do periodic reviews to make sure that we are on target to achieve those objectives. So there's still quite a bit of work that needs to be done. But the other key issue for us are the finance in terms of capacity building, technology transfer. These are all critical in terms of the implementation part of the instrument when it is adopted.
Well, it sounds like you're quite optimistic there, Ambassador Paolo Tuero. How likely do you believe that a plastics treaty will be agreed upon by 2024, as you said?
Well, we're quietly optimistic. but, we need to work harder. I think, again, although we are small countries, but we believe that, we are in a situation where we continue to advocate and argue for the positions that we believe in. And it's the only thing that we can do. I'm hopeful, quietly optimistic. But let's see how I don't want to preempt the outcome of negotiation at this stage.
Yes, well, best of luck there in Uruguay, and as you continue these talks, a lot of parallels with climate change, as you mentioned, but we'll see what happens with this plastics treaty and progress on plastic pollution. Thank you so much, Ambassador, for joining us on Pacific Beat this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was a chair of the Pacific Small Islands Developing Estates of Fatumanava, Paolo Lutero. He's also the ambassador of Samoa to the United Nations. And we were talking there about that plastics treaty, the aim to reduce plastic pollution around the globe being worked on there in Uruguay at the moment.
Pacific Beat.
And that takes us to the end of Pacific Beat. Thank you for joining me this morning. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan and hope you have a lovely day.